I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 194 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us, please go to caropop.com. This week's guest, Scott McCoy, is in so many bands that he's been doubling them up on tour. He recently returned from a three-week jaunt in England with Luke Haynes and Peter Buck, and McCoy's band, The Minus Five, opened those shows. Now The Baseball Project, McCoy's band with Steve Wynn, Peter Buck, Mike Mills, and Linda Pittman, is in the midst of its September doubleheader tour with The Minus Five. In fact, on this tour, The Minus Five is The Baseball Project, so all five musicians are playing musical doubleheaders. Meanwhile, McCoy's first band, The Young Fresh Fellows, has recorded a new album that will be coming out on vinyl on Black Friday Record Store Day. The Minus Five's latest album, Or on Penelope, came out a few months ago on Yep Rock. That's a lot of activity for anyone, but especially someone who suffered a stroke in 2017 and had to relearn how to put words together as well as how to play guitar. This may be a case where love conquers all. McCoy's love of making music and his fellow musicians' love for him. We spoke this time on a late Saturday night after the Baseball Project Minus Five van had pulled into a hotel outside Louisville, Kentucky. McCoy is a great believer in the power of music and culture. It's no wonder that Or on Penelope is a reference to the Odyssey, and his kickoff track, Words and Birds, includes nods to Ichiku Park and The Bird is the Word. And the bird is still the word, but not for long. The Minus Five has come a long way, from the downbeat folksiness of its early efforts to the hooky power pop of Or on Penelope. The joyful new effort also strikes a contrast with the disorienting 2019 Minus Five album, Stroke Manor, which McCoy wrote and recorded while early in recovery mode. He tells how he still writes differently since before his stroke, and he talks about how producer, engineer, and former Caro Pop guest Ed Stasium contributed to the new album. McCoy also gets into how he approaches lyrics and music these days, whether his writing process is different for the Baseball Project's story songs, and whether he has a project or band in mind when he opens a notebook and starts to write. His other bands, The No Ones and, yes, REM, come up as well. Then there's the experience of touring two bands with the same personnel at once, even as there's some instrument swapping involved. Is one band a heavier lift than the other for McCoy? Do they all take turns choosing the music in the van? Be sure to listen till the end, as McCoy shares a couple of anecdotes that illuminate in disturbing ways what it's like to travel this country right now. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Scott McCoy. Hola, America. Brian Eno has said this, you know, he said that he fully subscribes to David Byrne's idea of stop making sense. I just saw someone quoting this today about this, like talking about how lyrics, as long as they're not so dumb that they distract you, it's like, they're not as important, he says, as the music, because they become part of the music and you don't need to sort of literally analyze all of it.
I believe that, you know, I always was immediately struck by, you know, I Am the Walrus and Desolation Row, and, you know, I mean, records like that that you don't really know exactly what they're saying, but the words sound so good, you know, and that's what I go by.
I took the songwriting class years ago with Steve Dawson, who's a wonderful musician in Chicago, and we wound up writing a songwriting book together. And one of his exercises was write a song in which you choose the words based solely on how they sound and not what they mean. Mm-hmm. And I did that, and it was like, it was much easier for me to write the song without sort of overthinking all of it. Yeah. And I kind of liked it more than stuff that, you know, made more sense. Yeah.
That's kind of always what I do. and even more so now, since I had the stroke and my brain is a little more jumbled than it used to be in the language department. So it's really easy for me to go that way, you know.
So do you find writing lyrics is actually easier now because you're just not trying to, you know, fit everything into these tight pockets, or is it harder because that part of your brain
is still harder? It's still harder. Yeah. But I just don't really labor over what they mean. I want them to sound right when I'm singing them, but I don't really worry so much exactly what they're their meaning might be outside of the feeling you get from them, you know?
Right. Well, Stroke Manor, the previous Minus Five album, you literally took lyrics that you'd written while in your hospital bed after you had the stroke, and words that didn't exist, but you just were sort of writing stuff to see what was there, and then you're like, you just went with it, and that's what the album was. And it's a pretty cool record. It's kind of haunting, but it's also, pretty creative. So that, I mean, obviously you've lived by that rule on the new one or on Penelope.
Yeah, I
Still
mean,
have there's still a lot of sort of free associative
I've
stuff in there.
advanced a little bit from that stage where I don't think I make up words so much and don't know that I'm making up words like I did back when I was in the hospital bed. But I mean, it's the same principle, you know. That's why a lot of people said, you know, I said, well, the Stroke Manor, the words are just so bizarre because I didn't really know what was going on or what I was saying, but. Some people say, yeah, but they're not that different from what you wrote before or since. And I mean, I can see the difference, but they're right in a way too, because it's a process that I had kind of adopted a long time ago and that I've continued doing it. But then I didn't have any choice. I didn't have any choice in the matter. And now it's a little bit more like that than it was before, and do because I still struggle with trying to think of the words that I'm trying to say. You know, I might have an idea of something I want to say, and I think of a line. I think that's good, but by the time I try to write it down, it's gone. You know, because it just stuff doesn't words don't stay in my brain very well. But you know, I think in some ways I'm getting better. You know, when I really like on this tour, I'm not using a notebook, you know, I'm not using a music stand and all that stuff. And that makes for some really uncomfortable moments when I can't remember what I'm supposed to be singing, but it's a trade-off because I don't mind having a notebook. I don't mind seeing somebody using a notebook when they're singing or auto, what a scroller, you know, or
Right.
whatever.
No, I've seen a lot of older
Yeah.
acts, period,
Oh,
where
yeah.
they'll have the tablet and they'll sort of you could see them kind of looking down when they're singing
Right.
the songs.
Right. Yeah.
And it's, a lot of veteran, very famous bands, and you could sort of see them doing that. So you would not be alone in that
No. So,
regardless, but.
I don't mind it. I don't begrudge that for people. But what I do realize is that it takes me out of the moment when I'm singing the song a little bit because I'm too worried about being able to see the thing for one thing, and being able to read it, and if there's enough light and all that stuff. Because I mean, I can do it, but it saps me eventually, my emotional engagement a little bit, you know.
Yeah,
So
it
that's
sounds
why
like it's.
I'm willing to risk it. I mean, sometimes when they're brand new songs, I have to use them because I have to sing them like 100 times before they'll start sticking in my head. But now I'm getting to the point where I've sung a lot of the songs of the new record quite a few times, and so they're starting to I have a pretty good chance of getting 80 or 90% of the words right on any given night. And sometimes all of them, you know.
I don't know. I've written a bunch of songs and I feel like I would forget the lyrics to most of them if I was like put on the spot. So you're a pro. And it's what you do. Yeah. I mean, and so Words and Birds, the first song on the album, you have lines like inexplicable songs, purple twilight and dawn. And the bird is still the word, but not for long. If the birds forget the words, we all go wrong.
There you
So it
go.
seems like you're addressing that somehow in there.
I am for
And
sure.
putting a bird is the word reference in there too. So,
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I was doing. Both of those things. Because I mean, you know, a lot of the words I write, I have an idea of what I'm trying to say, but I also like to drop references to songs and literature and, you know, movies, all those things really come into my songs, you know. And I can tell you when I heard something, I can say, well, that's because of this bit from a movie or something like that. That's where I got the idea for that sound of those words or whatever, you know. There's things like that. I just like that, you know. That's fascinates me and it pleases me. So I do it for myself really more than anything, because people don't really catch a lot of them, and they don't really ask me about that much, you know. Sometimes it's obvious people get them, but like, for instance, Words and Birds, no one has said anything to me about It's All Too Beautiful, Man, you know. And that's just
Oh, I
that's
got that one.
yeah I mean, that's nobody's said one word to me about it. Anybody, people who play the songs or listen to the songs, anything. And it's like, you know, maybe because it's so obvious, but you know, it's small faces, you know.
Sure.
But also, it was exactly what I wanted to say, you know. So I got to say exactly what I wanted to say, and nod to a great song by a great group, you know.
Absolutely. Odyssey references. I mean, Penelope is from the Odyssey, so you're being influenced by that's classic rock right there if you're going to get into the Odyssey.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there's all what there, I've had so many references. I mean, so many things from Ulysses and the Odyssey. You know, those are kind of my foundation of in literature. You know, that everything kind of goes back to those sort of, you know. So I throw in constant references to them, even though I don't know those works inside out, but I've read them enough, and I just thought about them a lot. So I'm constantly going back to those, just dropping things from those, because they're infinite stuff that you can mine things from, ideas and words from.
When you're writing baseball project songs, is that a simpler task than writing,
It's a lot
Minus
different.
Five or Fresh Fellows, because it's like a specific little narrative that
Yeah.
you got to tell?
It's a lot different. It's more like, I mean, I would say like an assignment, like a journalistic assignment or something, you know. But it's not that cold, because I usually try to write ones from things that I have emotional connection to. You know, that's inspires me to write songs about people in baseball. But yeah, they're going to be a little bit more folk ballad oriented. You know, they're going to try to tell a story to some degree. You know, they're not all like that, because I do slip back into my Scott McCoy-isms, but more likely it's more of a linear approach to songwriting, and you're actually trying to say something that most people can probably understand.
Does the music have a different relationship to the lyrics in that case, because it's more driven by the words?
It can, but I don't think so. I mean, I think I, you know, I mean, I think I try to keep my music fairly simple in general. I used to try to make it a little more complicated, but now I really consciously try to keep it simpler, and more direct. I still think I write the same kind of songs. You know, I write country songs, I write folk songs, I write pop songs, I write rock and roll songs, and those are all in. I write ballads. Those are all in the baseball project, but those are all on and my regular albums too, you know. And Steve's the same way too. You know, we've always been proud of the fact that the baseball project is for baseball nerds, but it's also just for people who like music, even if they don't like baseball. You know, if they like our music, they should like the songs.
Absolutely. Like, for instance, if you're writing a song not for Baseball Project, there might be some where you sort of come up with a riff, you come up with the music, and then you kind of figure out what the words are going to be. Baseball Project, do you do that with that too? Or do you really start with, hey, I want to write a song about, Kyle Schwarber or something? I mean, like, you haven't done your Schwarber song yet, but, why'd the Cubs let him go? Boo. That's just my own personal lament, but do you come at it, more sort of make the music fit the words as opposed to making them?
No, I'm I almost exclusively Now, I'd say like 9 out of 10, or even maybe 19 out of 20 songs, I write the words without any music or any idea of melody or music at all. The lyrics are usually what's written, and then when it's time to make a record, I say, oh, I gotta put those three or four chords to this song and make a melody. That's kind of what I do. I'm always stockpiling lyrics. So that's why people say, have you written a bunch of new songs? And I say, no, I don't have any songs. And then when it comes time to do a record, I look in my computer and my notebooks and my phone, and there are songs, because I'm just always jotting them down and putting them, they're scattered every place. But and I find them, and lots of times I write the words, and then maybe I quickly pick up a guitar and I sing into the phone, and I have a germ of a musical idea. But typically it's all about the words. Words come first, and the music is the secondary thing. And that's why I think I'm not the most melodic writer, but I've gotten way better at it. As I've made my songs simpler, they rely more on melody than just me spewing out tons and tons of words as fast as I can, which is kind of what I used to do back in the fellows days, I think, which, not to say those aren't good songs, but it's just I didn't really ever think about melodies that much, and I've kind of learned to. That's sort of a nice thing to have a catchy tune.
Yeah, I mean, Aura on Penelope is just a flat out power pop record. I
Yeah,
don't feel you go along with that, but
it
I mean,
is
the minus five
absolutely
did not start like that. It was a moodier, more
right.
downbeat thing.
Totally. Yeah, psychedelic folk. And now it's a band, so it wasn't really a band when it started. It was just me and Peter and whoever came around, and we just kind of and we didn't even have drums on a lot of songs. We just strum acoustic guitars and then build up weird things on top of it. And but now it's we've been a band now for 25 years, where I play out shows as a rock band with the Minus Five. So this record is just kind of the culmination of all that, because it feels like a really near perfect to me, like power pop record or rock and roll pop record or whatever, that kind of thing. It's really joyous to me. That's what I like about this, because Minus Five records have not always been joyous
Right.
at all. And this one, even though the lyrics aren't all, hey, everything's wonderful, they have their darkness, but the feel of the music and the feel of the songs is that, let's go, let's do this. It's just it's a you know it, I wanted to make something that felt positive,
And it
and
is hooky. I mean, you got your hooks and melodies going on this, so your hook game is strong. No, like something, like in the middle of the album, Burgundy Suit. You got hand claps, you got Ooh La La, totally catchy, and it clocks in at just under 2 minutes. Like perfect pop song.
I don't really extend them too much, and I wanted to keep the record, keep the songs as direct as I can do it musically, pretty much. And I didn't layer tons of stuff on the songs. I really consciously made an effort not to overload them up with cool effects and stuff. There are some bits, but mostly it feels kind of like the songs did when we played them in the studio. They felt like a record,
And you're playing live in the studio. What I read that the first half of the album you knocked off in one day.
Those were all done in one day, with three other songs were done. We did nine songs in one day that nobody had ever heard or played or anything before, and they just came out so amazingly great. That just really encouraged me, and so I've been trying to work that way more and more since then. Because that was a couple of years ago when that session happened, and I put three songs on the Neil Young Volume 3 Minus Five record. Those were Hitchhiker and Of course, my brain is fried. Bad Facts and World Went Worse. Those are all three songs that I were recorded the same day as side one of Oran Penelope. But I had those kind of destined for a Neil Young record, one of my Neil Young tribute things.
And when you go into the studio, have you sent everyone demos, or are you just teaching
No.
them on the spot? And then they're
No.
just learning them, and then you're playing them, and you're recording them, and that's what we're
That's
hearing on the
it.
record.
That's it. Yep. That's what I'm really doing nowadays. It's really great. I really love it. And 'cause I mean, it's amazing what people came up with, I mean, we were talking about in the van today there, Mike Mills is playing an organ on these songs. And he's like, I'm playing that riff on Words and Birds. And I think I'm on that song In the Ground. It's kind of the same riff or something. And I'm kind of getting mixed up about which one is which. And I was saying, well, I didn't write either of those riffs, I mean, the Kurt and on Words and Birds, Kurt and Peter came up with that part, I mean, I just showed them the song and they started playing it and they started playing that. And so I was like, oh, that's really cool. And on In the Ground, it was I'd already recorded the song and John Ramberg just added that, as a little part, I think. So, it's like you come in with a song and let the musicians run with it, and it just makes it so much better. I mean, Linda is so phenomenal on this record. She makes the record, I mean, everybody played so great, but she was just incredible on it. She just came up with ideas, and a lot of those arrangements are based on her drum parts, and they all just happened like from the time I kind of showed them the chords to, a half hour later, the song was recorded, so they happened really fast,
And Peter's playing bass on it, right?
Yeah, and Peter played bass on the whole record, pretty much almost all of it, except for the two songs that I did with Spencer Tweedy.
Right. So it's interesting. Did you used to demo stuff, or is this always the way you've done stuff?
I like to, but I find out now when I do demos, my demos are so good that they become the record. So that means people are going to have to overdub to finish it, and like lots of times, the last thing it gets put on is drums, because I don't demo them like on a four track or just me playing acoustic guitar into the phone. I do it up and I put it on a drum machine, and then I play bass and guitars and vocals and everything. And it's like, well, I guess it's a demo, but it also sounds like a record, so I feel like, why should I redo it? That kind of thing. So that's why I'm trying to not demo stuff. I'm trying to
Right.
just bring a song in and play it and let people come up with their ideas for it, because it just makes it so much more exciting,
So, and you produced this, but Ed Stasium was mixing it. What was his role
Yeah.
in all of this? It looks like he was on some of the record too.
He was, but that was like I kind of mix the record as I go along when I'm working on it in my studio down. I mean, all this stuff was recorded at other studios, all the basic tracks and everything. But then I did the vocals myself at my house and in my basement, and added some things there, and had Debbie come over and do her vocals in my house. And so I kind of mixing them as I go along. So it sounded really good. I was like, this record's amazing. It sounds so good. But I couldn't help but think, I wonder what somebody else would do with it, just because I was, it's all, there's always too much of me on it, because I make all the decisions and everything like that. And so I'd always thought about Ed Stasium because I love so many records he's done that just sound so fantastic. And I thought, this could be a good record to see if, maybe he could work with it. And I didn't know him. I'd never met him or anything like that. And I talked to Dennis Daikin from the Smithereens,
Right.
worked with him, and Steve Barton, my friend from Translator, he lives in Portland now, and he worked with Ed too. And they both said, oh yeah, he's a really good friend of mine. Yeah, he's super cool. Just call him and ask him. Maybe, because I go, I don't know, could I afford him and all this stuff, because I don't really have a budget like from the label necessarily, because I just deliver records and I don't ask for money typically. But when I talked to Ed about it, he seemed really amenable and really wanted to do it. And we kind of agreed on a price, and he kept me a really good deal. And I asked Yeprock if they pitch in some money. They said, oh yeah, that'd be great. And so they pitched in some money, and I just handed it over to him, and the songs were all laid out, so there wasn't anything really had to do except make them sound great. But that being said, I told him what I said, that I didn't layer a lot of stuff on it. So like, I didn't put tambourine on every song, which I always want to do, but I wouldn't let myself do it. I said, if you want to put tambourine on, you can, but I'm gonna let you decide that. And he did put it on some songs, and it was really, I was like, oh, that's great. I'm so glad. But I let him do it. And he had some other things. There were some things that there was a thing on a guitar that I just couldn't play because my right hand doesn't work very well from since the stroke. And so I couldn't do the really chunky Johnny Ramone kind of thing. So there was one song particularly that I said, could you do Johnny Ramone thing at the on this song? Because I just couldn't do it, And
He's done Johnny Ramone before, so
yes,
he's the guy to ask to do
he
that.
knows it well. And and he said, oh yeah. So he did that. He put some guitar on a couple songs that I asked him to. And there's one I thought, oh, this could use a little guitar thing. So he did that. And he put some little Mellotron, some little cool little effects things on a few songs. So yeah, he added a lot to it. And those were all really great. All the things he added were fantastic. But the main thing he added was, it was just the sound. It just, a guy like that who's made records that have been played by millions of people, for 50, 40 years or whatever, there's something that he knows that I don't know. And that's just how to make a record sound like a real record, I mean, it's 'cause and so when I got it, I was just like, oh man, this just sounds so amazing, It wasn't like a whole day and night thing from what I sent him, but it just had that little something that just made it sound really cohesive and really powerful and really punchy. And so I was so happy that I had him do it, and he's a great guy too. And I didn't even meet him until after the record. I had never met him before, and so we kind of did a lot of zooming and just discussing the records. He'd send me a mix, and I'd say, "Okay, what about this?" and blah blah blah. But he was amazing. And since then, I've hung out with him a few times, and he's just a gem of a human. And the thing that was the best about him was he loved the record. From the second he heard it, he loved the music. He said, this is right up my alley.
Yeah, made total sense for him to work on this.
He made total sense. Every reference I made, he had that met reference. He knew exactly what whatever little thing I mentioned. He's like, oh yeah, because he's on the same wavelength, So it was a great experience working with him. He's a great guy.
He's quite a storyteller, too.
He is. He's been around. He's been in parts of so many incredible records. It's just it's awesome.
Yeah, I talked to him for Garopop, and I had like this list of questions about Ramones and Smithereens and Talking Heads, all this. And at first hour didn't get to any of it, and so we had to reschedule a second part. So there are two parts of it because it was like I'm learning about like Midnight Train to Georgia, which I had no idea he did. So, and how he was trying to make it sound like Al Green because that's what she wanted. I was like, oh my God, that's so cool.
I know, it's
Anyway.
amazing that he went way back to that, but yeah.
But back to you, of course. When you heard the mix that he sent back, was there anything that surprised you about it, or was it just like, oh man, this is just more what I wanted?
No, there he didn't do anything radical to any of the mixes, because they didn't need it, because He knew what I liked. He could tell what I liked, and he wasn't trying to exert his will on me or the music at all. He knew what I was going for, and he was just trying to deliver it, you know. And like I said, he did add some little things that really helped, you know, add some sparkle in a few places, and just, you know, cement the tracks together. But no, he didn't try to reinvent me. You know, he knew what kind of record I was trying to make, and he was all about doing that kind of record too. You know, so.
I listened to Little Steven's Underground Garage in the car, and and they were playing "Let the Rope Hold," Cassie Lee. I think "Blowing My Bag" I'd heard on there also.
They played. They played a lot. It's really great. It's really great.
And because it was like that, the experience of like hearing that band you really like on the radio, which I don't get that much anymore. So that was really cool because it's like, oh, it's new stuff that actually sounds like, you know, the stuff that's right in their wheelhouse. Do you ever have those like kind of that thing you do moment where you'll hear something that you've done on the radio and whether it's satellite or regular and still get some thrill out of it?
I don't have like serious. I don't listen to it, because I only like if I'm in a rental car or something. I don't have it at my fingertips, or I just don't do that stuff very much. But Ed listens to it all the time, and Linda and other people they're texting me all the time, like, I heard this on the radio, I heard this on Underground Record. You know, so everybody was hearing it and getting really excited by it. I would be flipping out if I heard it, but I don't really have the I don't know. I don't listen to the radio.
It was one of those
Even
things
though
where
whenever I do listen to Sirius Radio, I love it. I love listening to Underground Radio and Underground Garage and a lot of the other channels they have on Sirius, but it just doesn't happen to me. I don't, you know, it's really hard for me to. I just don't get to listen to enough music because I'm always working on music, you know, and it's kind of sucks. I mean, sometimes I do make time to listen to records, but it just you never know when it's going to happen because I'm always kind of busy with other stuff.
I don't wanna hate you anymore. Your greedy candles exploding. I don't want to hate anything. No, I don't want to shatter the sun.
How do you all travel from show to show? Are you in? Is there
In a
like
van.
a souped-up van?
Yeah, it's not really souped up, but it's a, you know, kind of sprinter vans kind of thing.
Do you take turns on choosing the music?
No, we don't listen to music that much. We John Hill, who's our tour manager, he puts on music. What he usually kind of only does it like late at night when we're driving. And then it's really awesome. He just puts on a mix, you know. He's got a ton, you know, a Spotify thing of tons and tons of mixed up tunes, you know. But once in a while, like the other night, he put on Village Green by the Kinks, you
Oh,
know.
yeah.
And we were all just, you know, it's like going home, you know. It's just like so sounds so amazing. And I was thinking, God, Linda, you know, Mick Avery, the drumming is so great on this record. Kind of reminds me of you. And she's like, yep. She's like, it was a really huge influence on me, you know. And I never thought about that before. But the way he played on that record, it's
That's
very
really
much
interesting, yeah.
reminds me of Linda. And she goes, you know, she goes, that was huge on me when I was first playing drums, you know. So it's funny.
So no music in the van usually, though. Were you
Well,
guys like,
not, you know, like I said, it's
looking at your
John Hill plays
phones
it, and
or?
we love what he plays. It's great because he has a mix that he plays of like really kind of 60s garage rock that we play like before the shows or during the shows when we're not playing, and so he'll play stuff like that, and he plays a lot of jazz, you know, kind of old Blue Note jazz, you know. Not super far out stuff, but not really boring smooth jazz either, you know. So like L Lee Morgan, and you know, just like kind of classic 50s and 60s bebop and stuff like that. So we love hearing that, but we just don't, I know it's funny, we don't really think about it. I mean, a lot of us are listening to stuff on headphones. You know, this is the modern van world,
See,
you
that's what I
know.
was wondering about.
It's not like everybody's, you know, throwing in cassettes. I mean, we and the fellows, when we were on tour, we always had to fight over who got to pick the next cassette that we were going to listen to, you know? And so that was a big thing back then, but it's not really like that so much anymore. And, you know, we're all often listening and studying songs on headphones because we're still working out the songs that we're playing and making, trying to figure out how to make them be right, you know, because I'm always pushing for new songs, and I'm kind of like a Nazi about not wanting to do the same set every night, you know, when it's the minus five at least, or the fellows. But when it's a baseball project, we all have to agree on it, you know. So we've been playing a pretty similar set for the first 3 nights, just because we were not really in the swing of things yet. I mean, we were playing great, but we haven't gone over all of our songs, you know, our huge catalog of songs. So,
Right.
and we're kind of focusing on getting to this festival and play it, and then move on from there, and we'll kind of stretch out a little bit then. But yeah, so what was I talking about? Listening to stuff in the van. Oh, so yeah, often we're studying songs on headphones. People are going over once, like I'm listening to songs that I can't remember the words to. I'm trying to force them in my head. And also, to be fair, we're Mike and Steve and Linda and I are pretty much always watching baseball on our phones, or at least monitoring scores on our phones and stuff like that. We do a lot of baseball watching and a lot of fantasy baseball work too.
So on this tour, the minus five is the baseball project.
Yes.
Same five people, both bands,
Yeah,
probably
but
fierce rivalry between the two bands, sabotaging each other's sets and
no,
stuff.
nothing like that. I mean, it's all for one and one for all, if man. And Peter's playing bass in the minus five and playing guitar in the baseball project. And so Mike is playing organ, which he's never really done in a band before. He's never just been the organ player, but I knew he could do it because
Sure.
he's a great musician. And I think it's a little weird for him, but I think he's enjoying it. Yeah, it's great, you know, because I realize that most of the songs on the record have organ parts on them, and so yeah, he's tackling those, playing piano on a few songs too, and yeah, it's going great. I mean, the sets have been awesome.
Then Steve's doing the leads.
Yeah, Steve's playing lead guitar. He was really nervous about it. I was like, dude, you're a lead. You play lead so much. He goes, I've never played really lead in another person's band. And I was like, well, you've played my songs before, you know, because we did, you know. And he always plays, usually plays lead on my baseball project songs, because I mean, I play some, but I prefer other people doing them in general. But he's great. He's playing the shit out of the songs too. It's awesome. I love his guitar playing, and he's amazing. Yeah.
So doing these double header shows, is it exhilarating, exhausting, all of the above?
Yes, both of those things for sure. I mean, yeah, I mean, we're not playing any longer than we played when we did two sets of baseball project songs, but it seems a little bit more tiring somehow, just because I don't know. I guess because maybe with the minus five, I'm really coming out charging, you know. I'm really amped, really fired up. And then the baseball project is a whole nother thing. We're all amped up together for that, but it's when we did the two sets with the baseball project, it's a little more relaxed, because you just
You're trading off a little bit more.
yeah,
You're
you're stretching.
really the focal point of the minus five.
Yeah, you're stretching out for a while, and so I'd say it's a little bit more intense this way, and I just appreciate that everybody's putting the effort into it, and we're making both sets be super awesome, you know.
I mean, have you had moments where you're like, what did I agree to? Or is this really
Oh,
still very fun for you?
I said, what did I make everybody agree to? As far as, because I feel guilty about it, because we just did the same thing in in England. We just did 3 weeks in England with Luke Haynes and Peter Buck because we just made a new record with them too. And Peter and Linda and I were all in that band. So I got Luke to play lead guitar in the Minus Five because we opened for the Luke Haynes show. And the Nick Fowler, the keyboard player in that band, played keys with the Minus Five too. So, I mean, I felt like there was a couple times I thought, why did I think this was a good idea? Just because I knew it was a good idea for me, but I wasn't sure if it was a good idea for everybody else because I thought I didn't want to burn everybody out and make everybody so exhausted. And I think I might have pushed a little too hard for it, but it just made sense to me because I have this new record out and I wanted to play the songs, you know?
How do you feel at the end of the night? Is it exhausting you or?
It is. Yeah, but I feel great. But I feel great. I mean, I think everybody can do it. I mean, everybody can do it. We, like I said, we're not playing any longer than we played before. We, you know, it's as long, the two bands together is as long as an REM show, you know. It makes it a little different because there's a different focus on both bands a little bit. So it's just, I think it's a maybe a little bit more stressful than when you're just playing one band, you know. But at the same time, it's also really fun. So
The Overseas show were pretty, that was pretty recent, right? I mean, like, did you go, like, it seemed like you went right from being, were you in England
yeah, England, yeah.
and then you just came back here, and it seemed like you started up pretty quickly
Yeah, we
after
had
that.
four days off.
Four days to get over your jet lag, basically.
Which didn't even happen. But
Because
yeah, so
you're on the West
that
Coast, so
was
you have even more jet lag.
yeah, that was the main thing. I was like, Peter and I were going, this is like be on tour for 2 months in a row, playing two sets every night with like three different bands. And we're like going, yeah, I don't know, maybe it wasn't the best idea. And Peter's going, I think we've said this before too. He's saying, I might be done with doing the opening for myself thing, you know. And I was like, yeah, I kind of agree, we'll probably agree to do it again sometime. You know, I don't know, but I know he said before, like, I'm kind of done with doing this, but then, you know, we're doing it two months in a row. So,
Right. Does he enjoy touring like you enjoy touring? Seems like it.
he's going to tour like after we finish this tour. I'm not going to do anything. I'm planning on not doing any touring for like 4 months, 4 or 5 months, hopefully. But Peter's going to be touring that whole time with his new band, Drink the Sea, which is with Barrett Martin. It's a brand new project, and they've got a record coming out. I think one of them might be out already, but they're putting out like two records, and they're going to be touring all over Europe and South America and the States. So he's full on.
And Mike Mills has that project with Darius Rucker. I don't know when
Yeah,
that's coming out or anything, but.
I think it's pretty close to being finished, and they're playing shows in December, I think. They're
Wow.
doing like 2 or 3 weeks of shows. So yeah. So I'm gonna be the slacker. Although the fellows have a record coming out in November, at the end of November on Record Store Day, but that'll just be the vinyl, and then the record will actually probably properly come out like early next year. And so I suppose we'll probably go do some shows on that, although you never know with the fellows. But I think there's a chance we'll do it, and it's a great record. We recorded it in one day at the Loft on when we were on the tour last year, on the 40th anniversary of the first Fellows record. We had one day off, and we went into the Loft and recorded 11 new songs.
Were these like new songs, or were these like kind of discovered songs or something like that?
They were brand new, and
Oh,
we had
wow.
nobody'd heard them, and none of them had been demoed. So we did the same thing, went in and just learned them. And I thought maybe we'd do like three songs, but we just kept pushing,
Kept
and
going.
I kept going, and yeah, I kind of killed everybody with that one. But the last song, Kurt was so sick. Jim and Kurt were both really sick, And Kurt was like, I cannot play one more song. It's like, well, we'll just do, which is the three of us. And he was like, okay.
I saw Supergrass last week, and I was sitting right in front of John Perrin, and so we had like a nice chat. And the last time I saw him playing was maybe with the Fellows, so.
He's the, this is the first record we made with him.
Nice. So go to go back to the songwriting thing real quick. When you're like writing your books and, notebooks and files and everything with all these lyrics on them, do you, as you write them, think, oh, this is a fellow song, this is more of a minus five song, or does that kind of sort itself out later?
It tends to be later. It tends to be according to whoever's recording, because there's some songs that I know are fellow songs, and there's ones that I've saved for years until the fellows get around to recording them. But otherwise, there's a lot of songs on the Minus Five records. Minus Five songs used to be way different than the fellow songs, and now they're kind of not really that different. But there's certain things that I know are, this has got to be a fellow song, this should be. And but otherwise, it's kind of determined by who's going into the studio, because then that's what I just look and see what songs I have, and there might be one or two that I go, oh, I can't do that one for the Minus Five because that's got to be the fellows or something like that. But in general, I write them, with a wide open mind, just to try to write a great song and then see where it fits.
And
But
then there's the no ones, which you've
yeah.
also written songs for.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Which we haven't done. I mean, now it's been a couple of years since the last one, but those are more collaborative, because a lot of those, there's one or two of those that maybe I kind of wrote by myself, and one or two that Frode wrote by himself, but mostly we collaborate on those. Like Peter and I will write them together. Frode and I wrote a lot of them together. He sends me rough demos of songs that where he's singing kind of nonsensical words, but he has really good melodies. So then I write the words to those songs. So that's good, because it's trying to make that a little more of a collaborative thing. So it's not just me doing songs and or Frodo doing songs, all four of us write for those records.
Right. And you're not doing it all in the same room. You're sort of sending stuff back and forth because you're on two different continents, but then at some point.
Well, sometimes we did the first record, they came over and we recorded together, but the second record was all pandemic, so they recorded guitar and drums, and then sent them over to Peter and I, and we overdubbed a bunch of stuff on them. And so it was more of a back and forth thing, but it got a good feeling of like live band, because they were recorded with guitar and drums together in a room, so that helps,
Right. There's a lot of stuff going on right now in this country and the world and everything else. Like, where does the music fit into it at this point? Is this kind of like sort of everyone needs a little relief from the just depressing, divisive, violent stuff happening all the time?
It's everything to me, because I mean that's part of the reason I wanted this record to have a real up feeling, have a feel like a positive thing, just because everything's so shitty, and now even more so, now that things, I mean, I have gotten even shittier, way shittier and way terrible and inconceivably sickeningly bad. Now it's like that's the only thing I can do is do music, because if I think about all that stuff, I'll just go crazy. I mean, I don't want to say I don't care what's happening with it, but I can't control what's happening with that. I'll protest and all that stuff, but the only thing that keeps me going is art, is focusing on literature, movies, and above all music, that's kind of, it's baseball helps a little bit too, but it's like, it's all the things I love. I just have to focus on those. Everybody, all my friends just say, well, we just have to keep making stuff, keep making stuff, and that's what we do. So that's kind of what we're doing.
I mean, a song on the new album is called "I Don't Want to Hate Anymore," which on one hand sounds like it's sort of a personal thing, like, you know, between two people, like, hey, you know, we need to get along. But also just that statement, just it fits a lot of situations at this point.
Yeah. Well, I had to be, I realized when I wrote that song, I realized that some people might take it as being a personal thing. It's a personal feeling, but it wasn't about anybody, any person. So I just said to my wife, Mary, I said, you might hear this song, you might think I'm directing a verse or verse or something, a part of this song to you, but it's not. It's directed to the world and to me and my feelings, you know, for what's going on, you know? And so I think she believes me. I hope so. Cause it's
really, I don't listen to songs and assume, oh, that's the state of this person's marriage or something like that. It didn't occur to me, actually.
Well, it's really true. And, you know, she's had some experience in this regard. So,
she's on the cover of the album. Look, so it looks great. So,
She's awesome. But, and our dog Gladys is on the back. And Gladys graces the t-shirt for the tour, too.
Oh, nice.
So
pick that up.
So that's a part of what the record too is. I wanted to show that this is my focus. It's like we have this little unit, we have this little family, and we can withstand all the shit that's coming from at us from every direction. That's kind of part of what I was thinking too with the cover and the record and everything too. And you know, there's songs on the record where obviously I'm probably striking out at the powers that be that are evil, like death the bludgeoner, you know. That's got some inspiration from what's going on, and I changed it to being a woman instead of being a male entity, because as death, you know, because I wanted the record to have more of a female perspective, and so I thought, mainly because I think the female perspective for the world is our only hope to survive, you know, and so, but I thought, well, you know, I should make this I can make this bastard, this Death the Bludgeoner, can also be female too, just to, you know, spread it around a little or something like that. But you know, it's obviously more patterned over, you know, the horrible people that are in power.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. And there's, and sexism's like at an all time high. I mean, like not to just reduce everything to isms, but I mean, you know, there are more women being attacked for being women than I ever imagined was possible. And I thought we'd sort of moved into a more enlightened.
Oh, it's sickening. We've gone back like 50 years in so many regard, you know. I mean, I say we, I don't mean you and I, but
no, I understand.
That's what they're trying to do. And man, it's been weird on this trip. I've already run into like three or four people. Of course, you know, it's in the South and stuff like that, but, and it's also run into some beautiful people, but some really weird things going on, you know, people like, on my flight going out to Atlanta, I had a, you know, a jacket with a bunch of badges on it, you know, from bands and stuff like that, because that's what I wear, you know. And I had one of the badges was from the band The Mummies, you know, the San Francisco band, and said, "To hell with the Mummies," you know. And the flight attendant was giving me my Cheez-Its or whatever. And tea, and she said, you're gonna have to remove that badge. It's offending the children." I was like,
"What?"
I was so taken aback. I didn't even know what she was talking about first. She's like, "That badge that says hell on it, it's really offensive to the children." I was like, "There's no children here. It's offensive to you." I didn't say that, but I was just too in shock.
And you're sitting in your seat, right? It's not like there are all these kids parading by you.
No, I'm sitting in my seat. And so the woman next to me was just like, "What the hell is going on?" You know? And But I was under shock, so I just took it off. I was like, I'm not going to get into this. But
Wow.
there's been something else happened like that. That was, oh God, I was we were at this Love's, a truck stop, and I came out from the bathroom, and this woman had gone in the woman's restroom, and she was an African American woman who, looked like she kind of like was dressed like a cheerleader, had like a little pleated skirt and everything. She looked really amazing. And I walked down, this woman said, "Did you see that woman? Did you see that person go into the bathroom?" And I was like, "Oh yeah." And she was, "I think she might be a man. I'm gonna wait out here until she comes out before I go in there." I was like, "I don't think it was a man, but whatever." She's like, "Yeah, well, I'm just gonna stay out here just to play it safe to make sure." I was like,
And she's telling you this.
"Yeah, and look at me." And I was at the time I was modeling this giant one of those giant fucking weird pink cowboy hats that they were selling at the truck stop. I was just laughing, and she's like, "You're talking to me like I'm gonna protect you from this woman or something." It was just like, it was so fucking weird. So I think they're just encouraging people to be afraid of everything that is nothing.
There's so much poisoning going on. The idea that someone would be afraid to go into the bathroom, that's just depressing.
It was
Oh,
it was
man.
so it's really weird. I mean, I've only been on this tour in this country now for like 4 or 5 days, and these things keep happening. It's really weird, but at the same time, we're meeting wonderful, amazing people too. So, you gotta keep thinking in those terms too.
And you'll be in Chicago soon, so.
Yes.
You
Chicago
know,
is great. Chicago's always great. Yeah.
absolutely. All right, final question.
Hollywood
Who's
Hall. Yeah.
the AL MVP?
Well, I want to say Cal Raleigh, because being a catcher is, a super, super stressful position, and he's been amazing, and he's hit a zillion home runs. And I think, you could say he's been so essential to the Mariners, because they haven't had much hitting this year and stuff like that, and he's carried them. But at the same thing, you could say the same thing about Judge, because Judge is, he's Judge leads in the statistical on all the categories except for home runs. And so I think either of them are totally deserving. I kind of want Cal Raleigh to win just because he's a Mariner, and it's a catcher. I think you need to recognize the work that they do on the other side of the ball, not just what they not just hitting.
That is the harder position.
And I mean, it's the position. It really is. It's everything is
There's a reason a lot of managers were former catchers.
exactly. So I'm gonna say Cal Raleigh, but I think it's very likely that Judge will win, and he's absolutely deserving because he's carried the Yankees too. I mean, usually they have a lot more help, and he's really been the guy to keep them going too.
That's all for episode 194 of Caro Pop. Thanks so much to Scott McCoy for joining us again and continuing an excellent ongoing conversation about music, culture, and life. The Baseball Project Minus 5 September Doubleheader Tour continues with shows September 18th at Thalia Hall in Chicago, September 19th in Kalamazoo, Michigan, September 20th in Pittsburgh, and subsequent dates in Jersey City, Somerville, Massachusetts, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., and other cities, finishing on September 30th in Atlanta. Go to baseballproject.net for more information and to buy tickets. Also, follow the Baseball Project and the Minus Five on Instagram and Facebook. Be sure to pick up the Minus Fives or On Penelope on Yep Rock, and look for that new Young Fresh Fellows album on Black Friday Record Store Day. Caro Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who's seen his share of frozen ropes and dying quails. Thanks to all who support Caro Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Caro Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at caropop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caro Pop on the so-called socials at Caro Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, Tell your friends and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop Conversation. Thanks.